You're listening to Fence Posts, Foundations for the Christian Life. Fence Posts is a teaching ministry of Pastor Mike Woodruff of Christ Church Lake Forest.
Study number 4, The Story, Act 1. So far, I've made the case that the book is to be believed, but I've told you almost nothing about what it says. That is about to change. In this study, we're going to climb to 30,000 feet and watch as the Bible begins to unfold. This is the story of good and evil, the story that frames all others. The fact that many people are unaware that the Bible tells a story, thinking it is essentially a collection of disconnected morality tales, religious poetry, and words of comfort, is both tragic and telling. Apparently, few people read the Bible, and those who do seldom read it cover to cover, assuming that they can make sense of the whole by picking and choosing a few lines here and there. It's my hope that in these next two studies, it will be the forest, not the trees, that comes into focus. In an effort to tell this ancient story in a way that engages 21st century readers, I'm going to present it as a drama, one that unfolds in three acts and comes complete with a prologue and intermission. This might sound long and complicated, but we really can't go far until we understand God's plan. In this study, we will consider the prologue and all eight scenes of Act 1. In the next study, we'll pick up the intermission and five scenes of Act 2. The prologue. Before the story actually begins, the Bible devotes about 10 pages to the events that precede it. This information, which is covered in Genesis 1 through 11, sets the stage for everything that follows. In fact, you have to understand the prologue if you hope to understand the story. Context is everything. In the prologue, we learn that time began when an eternal, holy, and all-powerful creator spoke the universe into existence. We also learn that the climax of his creative activity occurred when he formed two physical and spiritual beings, a male called Adam and a female called Eve. God not only made them to be like himself, in other words, they were made in his image, he also greatly loved them and placed them in charge of creation. Initially, Adam and Eve experienced unbroken fellowship with God, each other, and the rest of creation. They also enjoyed tremendous freedom. In fact, they were limited by only one rule. You shall not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. For some undisclosed period, their lives were rich and full. However, for reasons that are never fully explained, God eventually allowed evil to enter paradise through a fallen angel named Satan. The Bible does not tell us a lot about Satan, also called the devil, but it becomes clear that he has set up a counterfeit kingdom to rival God's, one that lays claim to all things and seeks to fill it by recruiting others. Adam and Eve succumbed to the temptations of Satan by violating God's clear instructions. As a result, four horrible things happened. First, they were mortally wounded. At the moment of their disobedience, they exchanged their innocence for a dark heart and became separated from the God they once loved and obeyed. This condition is called spiritual death. Additionally, they began to die physically. In fact, every area of their life was damaged and reduced. Number two, they became moral debtors who deserved the wrath of God. Adam and Eve's rebellion not only cost them a relationship with God, but it left them morally and spiritually bankrupt. They incurred a debt they could not pay and faced the punishment of a just God. Number three, their relationship with each other was fractured. Adding to their woes was the fact that their carefree love for each other had been replaced by an ugly and contentious scramble for personal power. From this moment on, they selfishly sought to master one another. And finally, all of creation breaks. Because they had served as vice regents over creation, everything under their care fell as well. This included nature, which became hostile and required diligent labor to subdue, and also their unborn children. The broken status of their sons is confirmed when one of them murders the other and evil spreads throughout the land. Now, thankfully, this is not all that happens. Before we're forced to watch the cascading effect of sin, two other events occur. The first is that a substitute death takes place. This first event, which is easily overlooked but remarkably shocking if understood, is a substitute death found in Genesis chapter 3, verse 21, where we read, "The Lord made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them." Sin truly is a capital offense. Adam and Eve have sinned and deserve to die, but God in his grace allows innocent third parties to die so that guilty people may live. He sacrifices several animals to provide for them. These animals are not only the first to give up their life, but the first to do so on behalf of others. Their death begins a trail of blood, or as some call it, a crimson thread, that will lead all the way to Christ's death thousands of years later. The second thing that happens is that a promise is made. As the prologue ends, it ends with a covenant vow made by God in which he graciously promises to restore mankind, reestablish his kingdom, and deal justly with sin. During the pronouncement of Adam and Eve's banishment from paradise, God states that one day he will send a rescuer to redeem them. This Savior will defeat evil, pay the moral debt of fallen people, and restore the rest of creation to its original state. The exact promise is found in Genesis chapter 3, verse 14, where it is made in the context of God cursing the serpent. This is God speaking, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head. You will strike his heel. In other words, God promises that one day he will send someone to destroy Satan, i.e. crush his head, rescue mankind, and restore creation. This rescuer will succeed even though he will be wounded, in other words, struck in the heel, in the process. The prologue continues for several more chapters, but at this point the stage is essentially set. When the curtain rises and Act 1 begins, we know that mankind was made in the image of God, but as a result of his own sin, has fallen into a state of spiritual death. We know that evil and chaos are spreading throughout the land. We know that man is powerless to make things right. In fact, he has now incurred a moral debt that he cannot pay and is totally at the mercy of his Creator, the very one he rebelled against. We also know that the Creator has promised to send someone to redeem mankind and restore creation. Will God follow through? Can he be trusted to keep his word? What kind of help will he send? When will it come? Will he rescue everyone? What does someone have to do to be rescued? These are the questions you're supposed to be asking as we settle into our chairs to await the start of the play. Scene 1, The Patriarchs. Scene 1 is named The Patriarchs after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the three men who dominate the account. The spotlight initially falls on Abraham, an unremarkable, idol-worshipping shepherd who is wandering about the Fertile Crescent. The year is approximately 2200 BC, and Abraham, or Abram as he is called at the time, is minding his own business. The first dramatic moment in the story occurs when, without any indication as to why he has been selected, God suddenly offers him a deal. Or, to frame this in theological terms, God offers to enter into a covenant relationship with Abraham. Let me give you a word about covenants. Because the Bible unfolds in a series of covenants, in other words, relationships of love and obligation between parties, and because there are several different types of covenants, three points need to be made right away. The first is that covenants can be classified as those that are made between equal and unequal parties. All of the covenants made between God and mankind reflect God's position of superiority. They are also initiated by God. In other words, man is not allowed to strike any deals. God alone determines the nature of our relationship with him, as well as the time and the duration of the covenants. Secondly, covenants may also be divided between those that are conditional. In other words, if one side breaks their promise, the other side is released from its obligations, and those that are unconditional. The Bible contains both. In fact, God enters into both. Finally, the first covenant that was made between God and man, which was made with Adam, was a conditional covenant of works. If man obeyed, God would bless him. If man sinned, he would die. Man broke this covenant. The offer God makes to Abram, which is referred to as the Abrahamic covenant, is different than the offer he made with Adam. The details are recorded in Genesis 12, where we read, "The Lord said to Abram, 'Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you I will curse, and all peoples of earth will be blessed through you.'" In other words, if Abram will follow God, God will not only provide him with land and descendants, but will bless him and his offspring in such a profound way that the entire world will benefit. This is an enormously important event. In fact, if you read it carefully, you realize that God is not only stating his desire to reveal himself to the world through the descendants of Abraham, but also his plan to redeem them through Abraham's bloodline. Everything that follows Genesis 12 is based on this promise. The long wait. Abraham takes God at his word, moves to Palestine, and waits expectantly for an heir. But God appears to be in no particular hurry, and so he and Sarah wait. They secure the land that God promised and even acquire considerable wealth, but Sarah remains childless. Instead of a baby boy, their days are filled with barrenness, foreign kings, natural disasters, and hostile neighbors. On two occasions, they attempt to take matters into their own hands, first by adopting and then through surrogate motherhood, but God makes it clear that neither path matches his plan. It's not until Sarah is 90 years old and all human hope has been exhausted that she becomes pregnant and gives birth to Isaac. At last, the plan of God begins to take shape. The binding of Isaac. We're told little of Isaac's early years, but one event deserves attention. While Isaac is still a young man, God commands Abraham to sacrifice his son on a distant mountain. The account is relayed in Genesis chapter 22. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about." This command must seem unthinkable to Abraham. What kind of God had he and Sarah agreed to follow? In good faith, they'd left everything in Haran to travel to a new land. In return, they had been promised descendants. For 25 years, that promise had not been fulfilled. Now, after finally giving them a son, whom they loved, God was requiring Abraham to offer him as a sacrifice. Can you imagine their anguish? What did Abraham do? Genesis 22 continues the story. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place he had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they had reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham!" "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all the nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." Well, what is going on here? Why did God make such a horrific demand? Part of the answer is found in the words of the angel. Abraham was being tested to see if he was willing to obey God unconditionally. But three other very important things are occurring as well. The first is, there is a trail of blood that is being extended. By asking Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, God was reaffirming the principles he established in the prologue. He was making it painfully clear to Abraham and to all those to whom this story would be told that sin really is a capital offense and that sacrifices are required in order for guilty people to be right with God. Secondly, Christ's sacrifice is being foreshadowed. By allowing a ram to be substituted for Isaac, God is reminding us that substitute deaths are allowed. Though moral debt is incurred by one party, an innocent third party may pay for it by offering their own life, in other words, their blood. Finally, God's love is being displayed. By demanding that a loving father sacrifice his only son, God is illustrating how much pain the rescue effort he is launching will cost him. Everything about this passage, starting with the fact that Isaac was Abraham's only son, and including Isaac's willingness to be bound by his father, points ahead to Christ. In fact, it must be noted that the mountain they were instructed to travel to is the same location where Christ would later be crucified. The decision to ask Abraham to sacrifice his only son as a payment for sin was a clear foreshadowing of the event that would later happen on that same mountain. From Isaac to Jacob. Abraham faces other adventures, and he eventually passes away. For a brief period, scene one focuses fully on Isaac, with whom God reaffirms the promises he made to Abraham. In Genesis 24, Isaac marries and fathers twin boys, Esau and Jacob. Jacob, the younger of the two, proves to be a liar and a cheat, but God loves him nonetheless. In fact, God not only modifies Jacob's character so significantly that he finds it necessary to change Jacob's name. In Genesis 32, Jacob becomes Israel. But he repeats to Jacob the promises he made to Abraham and Isaac. God then blesses Israel, in other words, Jacob, with 12 sons. These 12 sons become the founders of the 12 tribes of Israel. From Jacob forward. The last part of Genesis contains a story that shows the lengths to which God will go to protect his covenant people. Several of Israel's sons sell their younger brother, Joseph, to Egyptian slave traders, telling their father that he has been killed by wild animals. This breaks Israel's heart, but later proves providential. When Joseph rises from slavery to a position of great power in Egypt, he is able to rescue his father and brothers from a famine. This is just one of the many circumstances in which God preserves the descendants of Abraham. Scene one ends at this point. The rescue plan has begun. God has selected one man from among the masses and entered into a covenant with him, stating that through his bloodline, a blessing will come that will eventually extend to all of the nations. Scene 2, the Exodus. Though scene 1 ends well, scene 2 opens poorly. 400 years have passed since Abraham's heirs, now called the Jews or the Hebrews, left the Promised Land and relocated in Egypt. Though they are now 2 million strong, they have fallen into slavery, lost control of the Promised Land, and apparently lost favor with God. 4 centuries of oppression have passed, and despite their desperate cries for help, God has been silent. This is the situation as scene 2 begins, but almost immediately things take a dramatic turn. It begins when God breaks the silence by revealing himself to Moses, an 80-year-old shepherd living in the Sinai Desert. Like Abraham before him, Moses is minding his own business when the Lord suddenly appears to him and calls him into action. The account is recorded in Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. God clearly plans to use Moses to free the Jews from their Egyptian taskmasters so they can return to him. Four significant events follow. The first is, God reveals his name to Moses. Moses initially balks at the assignment. After agreeing to serve, he asks God for God's name. The conversation, which is recorded in Exodus 3, unfolds like this. Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" This question, "What is your name?" is far more profound than it may appear, because Moses is not really asking, "What shall we call you?" but, "Who are you? What are you like?" In the Hebrew culture, names implied more than what someone was called. God responds, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you." God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation.'" I could fill the next 50 pages commenting on this passage, but in an effort to stay at 30,000 feet, let me simply note three things. First, this is the first recorded time in history that God reveals his name to mankind. Prior to this, he had always been referred to by his titles. Second, the name God claims, "I am who I am," is a clear and bold declaration that he is in charge. His name is a proclamation of his self-existent, self-sufficient, and all-powerful nature. It is designed to say, "I will be who I am and not who you try to make me. I am not like the Egyptian deities you've been worshiping, toy idols crafted by the Egyptians themselves. I am the all-powerful creator of all things. I depend upon nothing except my own will. The world is mine and I control it." Third, from this point forward, most English Bibles translate God's name as Lord. That's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. The use of all capital letters is meant to distinguish it from the word Lord, capital L, small o, small r, small d, which is the translation of one of the Hebrew titles for God. Occasionally, some versions of the Bible translate the word as Yahweh. The trail of blood continues. The second major event in scene 2 returns our focus to the crimson thread that began in Genesis 3. Though God had charged Moses with securing the Jews' release from Egyptian captivity, the Pharaoh had no intention of losing his labor force. This set up a showdown between Moses and Pharaoh. When Pharaoh rebuffed Moses' request to allow the Jews to retreat into the desert for a time of rest, Moses announced that Egypt would be racked by plagues until he changed his mind. 10 plagues follow, beginning with the corruption of Egypt's water supply and ending with the death of every firstborn male. When the last plague hit and Pharaoh's own son was killed, he agreed to let the Jews go free. This 10th plague, which is commemorated in the Jewish Passover, is another place where God restates the original terms of the agreement. Sin is a capital offense. It creates a moral debt that can only be paid for in blood. In other words, guilty parties must pay for their sin with death. However, it is not necessary for the guilty party to die because substitute deaths are allowed. The instructions God gave to the Jews in Exodus 12 make this clear. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the people of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you and on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt." God required the Jews to sacrifice a lamb and drip its blood over the door frames of their homes for the very same reason he killed animals in the garden and instructed Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. These acts were done to reaffirm the law, promote justice, and point to Christ. His command to memorialize this event by creating an annual Passover celebration was done so that future generations would be forced to reflect on the sacrificial death of an innocent third party as well. After granting the Jews permission to leave Egypt, Pharaoh changes his mind and pursues them into the desert, trapping them on the banks of the Red Sea. It is here that God further displays his power by parting the waters long enough to allow the Jews to secure their freedom. The covenant is renewed. The third significant event to occur in scene 2 happens when the people meet God, renew the covenant, and receive the law. Following their remarkable escape from Egypt, Moses led the Jews through the desert to Mount Sinai, where God revealed his power in an awesome display of lightning and fire. God then explained the nature of their special assignment. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." In other words, the Jews have a job to do. They are to be God's show and tell. When they obey him, he will bless them. And as a result, they will become a conduit of his blessings to other nations. This calling, which is captured in what we refer to as the Mosaic Covenant, shapes Israel from this point forward. What exactly did it look like to be God's model nation? To answer this question, God gave Moses the law, a set of religious, moral, and civil commands centered on the Ten Commandments. The law served in three ways. First, it helped the Jews establish a healthy society. After 400 years of slavery in a pagan land, they needed very clear instructions about what kind of culture they were to establish. How were they to relate to God, to each other? How were they to structure society, solve problems, treat their children, resolve disputes? God had promised he would send a rescuer through Abraham. Most cultures are not healthy enough to last thousands of years. God created one that did. Second, it revealed God's nature. The laws God gave to his people were not arbitrary. They were grounded in his character and moral righteousness. The command to live holy lives helped them understand God's holiness. The command to care for widows and orphans helped them understand his heart of compassion. Third, it taught them about their sin. The law also helped the Jews realize their sinfulness. By clearly delineating what holiness looked like, the law helped the Jewish people realize their broken nature. No matter how hard they tried, they could not keep every aspect of the law. They lacked the power and even the desire to meet God's standards. Following the giving of the law, God instructs the people to build a tent where he will take up residence. The sacrificial system was established. The last major event to unfold during scene 2 is the introduction of the sacrificial system, which serves as another way God will solidify the themes associated with the crimson thread. In other words, sin is a capital offense, but substitute deaths are allowed. Placing the tribe of Levi in charge, God laid down a series of rules to govern an entire sacrificial system. The book of Leviticus explains the different types of sacrifices, how often they're to be performed, what type of animals were to be used, and exactly how the system was to work. It's easy to get lost in the details, but at the center of the system was a simple process. Those who violated the law were required to take an unblemished animal to the priest. A special ritual was performed in which the guilt of the sinner was symbolically transferred to the animal. The animal was then killed, and its blood poured onto the altar as payment to God for violating his moral order. After God spelled out the details of this system, the sacrifices began immediately. Hundreds took place at the temple every day, thousands every week. These went on for over 1,000 years, being repeated daily in order to anchor the foundational ideas behind God's covenant with man. Sin is a capital offense, but substitute deaths are possible, so that guilty people can go free. Fear over faith. After God had established the foundation for Jewish life, he commanded the Jews to return to the land he had given to Abraham. Remarkably, they refused to go. Despite his ability to secure their release from Egypt, part the Red Sea, provide food and water for their march through the desert, not to mention the additional ways he manifested himself to them on Mount Sinai, they doubted his ability to successfully lead them into the promised land. Their fears overruled their faith and set up a pattern of disobedience that plays out throughout the rest of the Bible. Because of their lack of faith, they were forced to wander in the desert until all of the adults who were part of the decision to disobey God's command have died. It takes 40 years before they are able to enter the promised land. Scene 3, the conquest. Scene 3, which is told by Joshua in the book that bears his name, is the relatively brief account of the reconquering of Palestine. After 4 decades of wandering in the wilderness, Joshua led the nation of Israel across the Jordan River and into the promised land. Through a series of battles, they drive out most of the wicked people living there and reclaim much of the land that had been promised to Abraham. Scene 3 ends with Joshua's farewell address, in which he pleads with the Jews to honor the covenant by loving God and keeping the law. Scene 4, Judges. As scene 4 opens, we learn that the Jews have chosen to ignore Joshua's counsel. And during the 300 years that follow, we watch as they continue to disobey. In fact, the Jews fall into a cycle of rebellion and repentance that showcases just how dark the heart of mankind really is. Step 1 is they set aside the law's clear instruction to worship God alone and live holy lives, choosing to embrace the religious ideas of their neighbors instead. Step 2, God withdraws his favor from them and they are overrun by their enemies. Step 3, they cry out to God for help, promising to be faithful to him and otherwise honor the covenant. Step 4, God hears their cry, raises up a great warrior called a judge, and overthrows their oppressors. Step 5, chastened by their apostasy and thankful for God's deliverance, they are briefly faithful. But they soon grow lax and return to their old patterns. Instead of obeying the law, every man does what is right in his own eyes. This pattern is repeated over and over and over throughout scene 4. Scene 5, the United Kingdom. Around 1000 BC, the 12 tribes of Israel announce that they want a king, blaming all of their problems on the lack of a leader they can see. Samuel, the last judge, warns them that an earthly king will tax their income and force their young men to serve in his army, but they are not dissuaded. So God instructs Samuel to give them what they are asking for. This sets up a new form of government, one in which God leads the people through a combination of prophets, priests, and kings. The prophets. Samuel not only serves as the last judge, but also as the first in a long line of prophets, men such as Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and others who act as God's mouthpieces. Their responsibilities include both forthtelling and foretelling. Forthtelling generally involved relaying God's displeasure with the Jews for failing to honor the terms of the covenant. Foretelling includes predictions about the future and reassurances that God would keep his promises. Some of these foretellings provide more detail about who the rescuer will be, what he will be like, and when he will come. But often the prophets were charged with delivering harsh words and stern rebukes. Of the three offices, prophets, priests, and kings, that of the prophet was the worst. They tended to be lonely people who were only pressed into service when things were getting so bad that the kings and priests couldn't handle it. It was not an easy assignment. But the prophets served an enormously important role, and their writings make up about 1/3 of the Old Testament. The kings. The first king Samuel anoints is Saul, a tall, good-looking young warrior straight out of central casting. He starts well, but after a few months of promise, grows proud, loses favor with God, and becomes a significant disappointment. The second king Samuel anoints is David, the youngest son of Jesse. It is years before he actually assumes the throne, but when he does, he proves to be a brilliant and much-loved leader. During his tenure, he unites the 12 tribes, defeats their enemies, establishes Jerusalem as their capital, expands their borders, and fills the treasury with gold. In so many ways, he is everything the Jews could hope for in a king. Additionally, David proves to be a man after God's own heart. In fact, his love for God is such that God not only renews the covenant he made with Abraham and reaffirmed with Moses, he goes beyond that, entering into an unconditional covenant with David in which he promised him that, "Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." In other words, the rescuer will come through the bloodline of David. Unfortunately, like every prominent figure in the Hebrew Bible, David is flawed. Though he pursues God with vigor in his youth, his decision to ignore the clear prohibition against having more than one wife proves disastrous. The accounts of his last years read like the headlines for today's grocery tabloids. Upon David's death, his son Solomon ascends to the throne. Like his father, Solomon is faithful in his youth and, as a result, is remarkably blessed. Among his most significant contributions is the construction of a spectacular temple in which to worship God. The descriptions of Israel's material wealth and military dominance during his reign are staggering. Indeed, in the future, the Jews look back to the reigns of David and Solomon as the high water marks for Israel. It is during this time that they believed they are enjoying God's blessing. Unfortunately, it does not last. Though Solomon enjoyed a reputation for wisdom, he foolishly followed his father's practice of having multiple wives. This eventually led him into the worship of foreign gods and caused God to withdraw his favor. Upon Solomon's death, the kingdom passes to Rehoboam, one of the many sons. Unfortunately, Rehoboam's first act as king is to increase an already high tax burden, which led to a coup. David's kingdom is divided in two, and both halves begin to falter. Scene 6, the divided kingdom. Rehoboam maintains control of two of the 12 tribes, Judah and Benjamin, which from this point forward are referred to simply as Judah. But the other 10 tribes, which retain the name Israel, unite under Jeroboam, one of Israel's promising young leaders. The 10 tribes of Israel immediately turn their back on God and begin a descent into oblivion. Over the course of the next 300 years, a series of prophets, namely Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Obadiah, Jonah, Amos, Joel, and Hosea, warn, threaten, and beg them to return to God, but they refuse. From the time the kingdom splits in the 10th century until they are overrun in 722 BC, not a single king of Israel chooses to follow God. As a result, he withdraws his hand of protection, curses them instead, and they are overthrown by the Assyrians. The 10 tribes of Israel are never heard from again. Judah fares better, though not substantially. There are a few good kings, and consequently, a few times of spiritual renewal. But over time, the people's hearts grow cold towards God, and despite the fate of Israel and the warnings of another set of prophets, namely Isaiah, Jeremiah, Micah, Zephaniah, Nahum, and Habakkuk, they turn away. As a result, God withdraws his hand of protection and allows them to be overrun by the Babylonians. In 605 BC, the first of three deportations occurs. In 597 BC, a second wave of men and money is taken to Babylon, and in 586 BC, Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is ransacked, and the remaining Jews are carted into Babylonian captivity. But wait, how could God allow them to fall? Hadn't he promised unconditionally to Abraham that this would not happen? Yes, he had. In order to follow what happens next, you must be clear on 4 points. Number one, what happened to Israel and Judah is exactly what was agreed upon in the Mosaic Covenant. God's promise to the Jewish people was that if they obeyed him, they would enjoy prosperity, health, and safety. But if they disobeyed him, in other words, they broke his law, they would face poverty, sickness, and terror. They disobeyed. God was patient with them in their disobedience. Over and over, they walked away from him. This pattern of disobedience went on for hundreds of years until not bringing judgment upon them would have been a violation of his covenant vows and fatal to their destiny. Moses had promised them that if they broke the covenant, they would suffer God's curse. This is what happened. Point number two, what happened to Israel and Judah reflect the limitations of the old covenant and the fallen nature of mankind's heart. God had given his people the law, a clear set of expectations about how to live. But, as Jeremiah wrote in one of his warnings to the people, the heart is more deceitful than all else and desperately sick. The law proved ineffective in saving mankind because it did not change the human heart. It would reveal lawless behavior, but not correct it. Point number three, God sustains a remnant of Jews through the time of exile. The 10 tribes of Israel were abolished, but a remnant of the 2 tribes of Judah were sustained. This means that God remained true to the promises he made to Abraham. Finally, God announces a new covenant. Having established that the people of the covenant were not able to honor the terms of the old covenant, God uses the prophet Jeremiah to announce that he was preparing to make a new covenant with the nation. Quote, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." End of quote. This is an altogether different arrangement. What is described by Jeremiah is a situation in which God's law is written on the people's heart and where the sins of the members of the new covenant are forgiven by God and never recalled. This is a day to look forward to, and to that end, it provides hope for the Jews at a time of overwhelming regret and sorrow. Scene 7, the exile. The books of Ezekiel, Daniel, and parts of Jeremiah focus on the Jews during their 70 years in Babylonian captivity. This is perhaps the lowest point in the history of the covenant people, for it is here that they suffer the curse of God for failing to follow the covenant their ancestors had agreed upon at Mount Sinai. God had raised them up from one man. They had enjoyed his favor and become a superpower. But in their prosperity, they had walked away from him. And despite the frequent warnings they were given by the prophets to change their ways or face national destruction and exile in a foreign land, they had refused to return to God. As a result, they lost their land, their freedom, and even the altar they needed to atone for their sins. Ezekiel and Daniel assure them that God Almighty retains the power to carry out his plan and that he will. But it is a bitter time for those who remember the glory days of David. This is one of the lowest points in the history of Israel. Scene 8. In the final scene of Act 1, the Jewish situation begins to improve. In 539 BC, the Babylonians are overthrown by the Persians, who allow some of the Jews to return home. Under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, a modest restoration of Jerusalem takes place. But modest is the key word. Israel is no longer the world power she once was. Gone is the glory of the past. What is left is a small remnant. It is at this bittersweet moment that the curtain falls. Act 1 is over. In 8 scenes, spread out over nearly 1,600 years, we have watched as God has worked through the events of history. It appears as though he is moving towards fulfilling the promise that he made. One man's descendants have risen out of obscurity to a position of dominance, but they have also nearly marched themselves into oblivion. At the moment, only a small remnant remains. Will God prove faithful? Will the Jews enjoy his favor once again and receive the blessing through which the entire world will be blessed? If so, what will this blessing look like, and how will it be claimed? These questions have not yet been answered. They will need to wait for Act 2.
If there's any way we can help you on your spiritual journey, please contact us at cclf.org or email us at fenceposts@cclf.org.